or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Later in the show, I'm going to take a risk. I saw a chorus line at Woodminster Amphitheater Friday night, and it had a scene in it that was the most career relevant one could imagine, especially for people who have dreams. These are chorus line, in case you don't know, it is about a chorus line and their stories, their human stories and their dilemmas. And so later, there's a scene, unfortunately, it's got seven people in it, but I will try to play all seven roles. It really brings to light in a much more powerful way than I think one can in real life describe the dilemmas. And then I'll use that to kick off a little bit of a discussion with you on that whole question of dreams and artistry and fears and all that good stuff. But first, on a perhaps more mundane but more widely applicable practical note, many people rise to positions of manager or leader with either no training or training that's very theoretical. In other words, they get an MBA, but they're not necessarily really feel comfortable in the role of manager and leader, whether they're new at it or even if they've been at it quite a while. And of course, there's been tons of articles and books and videos on how to be a good manager and leader. But as I was reflecting on all of that and on what I wanted to do on today's show, it struck me that everything that is written or that is third party is too abstract to be applied. So I decided to take on this challenge. I pretended that I am the new manager or executive, whatever, supervising a bunch of people. And this was my first meeting with them. What would I say? So you never want to talk too long. So I created this, like, I don't know, it's about 3 minutes little talk that I think embeds a lot of the best practices in management and leadership. Now, of course, you know, every situation is different. So, I'm not saying use this verbatim, but maybe it's a useful way of trying to teach, if you will, great management and leadership skills without the pomposity of, a book or a set of articles. So, okay. So imagine you are my supervisee, my employee, and I just walk into the room. I've had you come to the meeting. I say, well, thank you all for coming. Thanks all for being on time. I want to start out simply by saying to you that I really do want to do everything I can to be a manager whom you'll respect and who facilitates your being your best selves. That's my goal. And to that end, maybe you'll find it useful for me to briefly tell you my philosophy of management, so you know what to expect. I believe in treating each of you not equally, but fairly. You are all individuals, and so you all have different needs, different strengths, different weaknesses. For example, some of you do best with lots of freedom. Others really deep down prefer closer supervision, more accountability. Some of you might really like very specific instructions about what you're supposed to do. Others would consider that micromanagement. I will try to flex to meet each of your needs. My main job really is to create an environment that enables each of you, as I said, to be your best self. And to that end, I really do encourage you. I can't know you really as well as you know yourselves. I encourage you to let me know your strengths and your weaknesses and how you and I might tweak what you do, how you do it, so you can be your best self. Well, I can't really expect necessarily that you're going to do that and come to me and tell me your strengths and weaknesses if I don't do it. So let me try to lead by example. I'm going to tell you a few of my strengths and weaknesses. Strengths. I'm pretty good at coming up with ideas and practical plans for implementing them. Not bad at addressing problems when they come up. I do work hard. You're going to see me here early in the morning, kind of late, and I'm not going to take a lot of breaks. Don't get intimidated. I'm not expecting you all to be workaholics like me. Not one more strength. I try to run crisp meetings. I don't schedule too many meetings. I think they're often a waste. So I'll be really careful with your time. And I will send a very tight, crisp agenda in advance to you and try to keep to them. One more strength, I guess. I really do try to have a sense of perspective and try to recognize how important is that really, or how important isn't it really in the larger scheme of things. All right, weaknesses. As you probably can already tell, I tend to be intense. I do not expect you to be as driven as I am. Just don't be intimidated by my intensity. I'm harmless, unless you're lazy or hurtful or dishonest. Another weakness I want to let you know about is that I tend to interrupt. I know it's rude. I just can't seem to make myself stop. I apologize in advance. It's nothing personal. Okay. Now on to another point. I'm aware that most managers say they have an open-door policy, and they welcome questions and concerns and suggestions, but in reality, you and I all both know. Not all managers really do. I really do. So if there's bad news you need to tell me about, please, I'd rather hear it early when there's time to address it. Sure, I mean, if it's a problem that you likely can solve without me, that's great. I mean, wonderful. But if I need to know, please tell me. I will respect you, not denigrate you for that. And yeah, sure, I appreciate self-starters, people who can get the job done without a lot of help, without much help. But I sure would rather you ask for help than you not get the job done on time, or you get it done, but you get it poorly. Talk to me. And, you know, this is like standard management, comes out of the management books, but I am going to start things off so that I don't, there's a lot of institutional history here that I don't have about you guys. So I'm going to meet with each of you individually. Yes, to hear your ideas, your concerns, your advice for me in my new role. I may not listen to may not do everything you say. That's not, I can't do that, but I will listen, I promise, and consider it seriously. Some of you may wonder, how important is our work anyway? After all, we're just a small cog in this very large wheel here at the Amalgamated Distribution, Inc. But when you stop to think about it, we 10 people are responsible for ensuring that countless products get to stores so that people can get the things they need for themselves, for their families. Think of how you feel when you go to a store and the item you expect to be there isn't there. Our job, we 10 people, is to make people happy and not disappointed. That is important and ethical work. We can go home to our families every night and feel proud of what we do. And on that note, let me reiterate how pleased I am to be your manager, that I realize that a manager can make a big difference, positive or negative, in the lives of his or her employees. I do take my responsibility to you seriously and to the company, and I will do everything I can to earn your respect and to make this one of the company's most respected work groups and to make this a place you're going to look forward to coming to every morning. Onward and upward. Okay. So that's kind of it's pretty generic. Again, it would be different depending upon the circumstances. But that's kind of a generic talk that I would give if I were a manager or a leader, whether I was the CEO or I was just an entry-level supervisor or foreman. So think about what principle. There were a lot of principles in that little talk that were embedded. I made clear that I was not trying to treat everybody equally. That's a dangerous trap. Not everybody is equal. And I think that laying that out, that my goal is to be fair and not equal, is a very important thing to lay out in front. Two, I really tried to use a tone of voice that was not quite like I'm your peer, I'm your buddy, but that I am going to be a collaborative, kind leader, but who's got expectations. I slipped in there that, you know, don't be intimidated by me unless you're lazy, dishonest, or whatever. That's, you know, that kind of got the point across that people are not going to walk over me. So I tried to strike that balance. Too often managers try to be everybody's best buddy, or that you're too authoritarian. There really is a lot of balance required there. I also got them to think about their own individual situations. Maybe sometimes they're not conscious of it. Do I really want more freedom? Do I want more accountability? Do I need more directions? It gave them an advance idea of the kind of things that I'm going to want to chat with them about individually. Right? And I told them up front in advance that I'm going to talk to them individually so they have time to think. And they're going to be nervous, but it gives them a chance to think, to plan. I tried to model my own behavior. They say, you know, don't judge a person by what he says, judge him by what he does. So I made a point of deliberately mentioning my strengths and my weaknesses. Again, I didn't want to be just this self-immolating person talking about only my weaknesses, but I also didn't want to talk about my strengths. So I was very candid about my strengths and my weaknesses, not crappy weaknesses, substantial weaknesses. So they really felt that I was trying to establish an atmosphere of candor. I acknowledged that, you know, kind of a little self-deprecation that, you know, all managers say they welcome and open to a policy. I acknowledge that that's BS and often, but that I wanted to reiterate that I really did mean it. And let's see, anything else that was core messages? Yeah. Everybody wants to feel important. And so, you know, I deliberately picked an example of what probably is a very unimportant job, some kind of logistics position for the Amalgamated Distribution Company. I thought of the most generic name I could. And yet even that, if one stops to think about it, is important. And my job as a leader is to inspire one of the jobs. And I tried to make, without at all exaggerating, I tried to explain why even that very most mundane job, that small cog in that very large, seemingly inconsequential wheel, was actually very important so that everybody would feel like they had they were proud of what they did. And I deliberately used very human terms. I talked about when you go home to your family and put your head on the pillow at night, you know, you'll feel good about what you did. So, and yeah, then I tried to make clear that I take my responsibility seriously. Because there really is a continuum of human beings, those who try to get away with as little work as they can get away with and not get in trouble, and those who try to do the most work because they feel it's cosmically a good way to live life, a good way to fulfill your responsibility, and a good way also to avoid getting fired. So I made really clear in my tone and in my words that I'm taking my responsibility seriously. I said to the company, but I also said to you, that I cared. I have almost a custodial responsibility in some sense. You know, I'm like the dorm resident manager in a college. My job is to make sure that the people have as good an experience there as possible, because I realize that managers are important. So those are the principles I intended to embed in my in this little mock talk that I would give, trying a hopefully a little innovative approach to the teaching of management. So now it's time to turn to you. If you are a manager, an aspiring manager, a leader, and you have either a question about your own situation and would like me to try to help you, or if you have a comment about the mock talk that I gave to what I would give to new employees, I welcome your calling for what I call a 3-minute workover. It's an umbrella catch-all term for whatever career problem besets you or someone you love. But especially if it is relating to leadership, management, supervision, is a particularly good time to call. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. While I'm waiting for your calls to come in, I'm well aware that this is the time now that new graduates, college graduates or graduate school graduates, you know, many of them say, okay, I'll take a week or a month to take off after I graduated, and now I'm going to start looking for a job. Well, graduation is typically the end of May, and now they're finding the realities that our insatiable desire to have people get college degrees, and college is, in my mind, a completely unethical approach to taking in as many students as possible without regard to employability, even in majors that are clearly supposed to be career-related. These graduates are now facing the reality that there is just, you know, even graduate degree holders, but certainly bachelor's degree holders, there's a gross oversupply in most fields, except for things like software engineering. And so we've got calls on the line, so I'm going to go to the phones. But after I do that, I want to tell some stories of some new graduates and some advice. As I always do, I never present problems without presenting constructive solutions. So I will talk about solutions for new graduates. But first, let's go to the phone. I'll give out the phone number again. If you want a 3-minute workover for any reason, you or someone you love is having a career problem, you're stuck, I will try to help you get unstuck. And especially because I just talked about management, if you have a question about leading, managing, or even dealing with, about leading or managing, all of those are good reasons to call Work with Marty Nemko. The phone number, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And it is your turn on the air. Welcome to the show. What's on your mind?
Hello?
Hi, it's you. Yep.
Hey, sorry about that.
No problem.
I have an earpiece, so I forgive the connection. I've been self-employed for a while, and I've been wondering if you have any hints about delegation. I'm having a hard time delegating work to people that I consider difficult and tend to take on more of the work burden than I should. I want to be a collaborative worker, and I don't like playing an authoritative role, but I'm finding it necessary. Do you have any advice or comments on making the transition between doing all the work yourself and getting people to work with you.
Absolutely.
In general.
Well, what was interesting is the way in which you worded it. You said you have difficulty delegating to people you find difficult. Are you saying that these people are not really, you know, if you had a superstar working for you, you would probably be less reluctant to delegate to them, right? Is it the is the problem that these people would really do a significantly worse job than you would do on it?
Almost always. It's very rare that I can hire someone who is better than I am at a particular task. And when I do find those people, I'm more than willing to give them a lot
exactly.
of rope and a fair amount of money.
Right. So it's not, I'm going to interrupt you. So it's not that you're a micromanager by nature. It's your hiring practices are no good.
That's correct.
Yeah. And so, I mean, that is, as I've said often on the show, there was a study done by the Gallup organization of America's 60,000 top-rated managers and leaders. And they asked them for what the keys to their success and being a great manager were. And number one, far and away above all the rest, is hire slow and fire fast. They take the time to mine their personal and professional network to find great people and treat them wonderfully. But if they make a mistake and they hire somebody who they cannot delegate well to, yes, they'll spend a short amount of time trying to see if it's simply a matter of training them a little more carefully, trying a little different approach to management. But after a relatively short amount of time, if that doesn't work, they cut them loose and try somebody else. The fire slowly, right? So you were calling to have the symptom treated, which was to get you to delegate more, but that really was the symptom, not the root cause. The root cause was your hiring practices. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does, and thank you. My few successful people that I've kept around were indeed hired slow, and so that jived. I really appreciate it. Thank
and
you.
Also, I want to stress again, because of the rampant and underemployment rate here in the Bay Area and nationwide, you have a lot of very desperate people. And so when right. you place an ad, there is a lot of dishonesty that goes on in the resume, and they're also very coached. Their references could be phony. You know, there's all kinds of things, and that's why it's particularly important in these times to rely on the people who you already know as referral sources, because they're not going to refer you. They're less likely to refer you somebody who's a problem. So you start by sending an email or a phone call to every human being on the planet whom you respect and say, these are the things that I'm really looking for in this employee. Is there somebody outstanding that you care to refer? That's how you hire good people. Okay? All right. Thank you very much for calling. Work with Marty Nemko. You're welcome. Take care. Let's go right back to the phones. I'll give out the phone number one more time. If you have a career question or a problem, especially if it's related to issues related to management, because that's what we did, we started the show talking about, I invite you to call. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Back to the phones. It's your turn on the air. How can I help? Hello, it's you.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes. I have a friend who works at the Berkeley Lab who needs some advice, mm-hmm. And it's he has no interest in management whatsoever, or mm-hmm. he might still be able to work at the lab.
Mm-hmm.
He's due to be laid off in about a month or two because of the cuts in the federal government, you know, the Department of Energy that funnels the money. Although mm-hmm. technically he's been a University of California employee at the lab for more than 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
And he'll, in a year or so, he will be 60 years old, and he could retire with benefits.
Mm-hmm.
But in 2 months, he won't have any employment at the lab. And he's an R4 level employee, and there's a chance that he could find a position in very similar in a department not far from his, but it would be like a beginning position. And he's not the money isn't a concern. It's for one thing, it's a paperwork job. He likes the lab job. He doesn't like paperwork, doesn't like management. Now, he has a master's degree and a BS degree, both from Caltech in mechanical engineering, but he also has a master's degree in applied math, and he's taught part-time at a junior college, taught math courses for about 20 years. But he has no, you know, he doesn't need the extra hours. He's already teaching several classes at a junior college, but that doesn't help him with the money that would go towards, you know, making sure that his benefits are good. And I suggested that he could try to get a job as, say, an instructor for something through the UC Berkeley, or UC Extension system, or any job that he gets through the University of California. His benefits would still be good in a year, and then he could retire. Then he could do, you know, what he wants to do, which is to teach math full time.
Well, my way would be always to be making, he should make a list of five human beings. I don't want it to be too big and intimidating a number, but five human beings who he should talk with and say, here are my best strengths. I know how to run a lab. I know how to teach. I don't like paperwork, and I don't like management. Lay out your strengths and weaknesses and say, how could I serve you? I don't particularly need the money, but I am concerned about the retirement benefits or whatever it is.
Well, he needs to work at least 51% or something. You know,
I understand.
He could work half time, and that would be okay.
I understand.
And the money is not a problem for him, you know.
I understand.
Yeah.
So I would make that pitch to the five people. And then if it didn't work and he couldn't get anything within, get either something created for him or
about 2 months. He got the letter saying you'll be terminated October 1st.
Yes, yeah. I got it. So if those five conversations don't lead at least a potential for future employment, yeah. It sounds like he's not financially bad off, and you can buy yourself a lot of freedom by saying, okay, screw it. I have enough. Maybe I'll have to scale back my expenses, but my real love, from what you said, is to teach.
Yeah.
There is so many ways that a man like him could teach young people starting out who have never run a lab. He could do he could then go to Stanford, or he could go to UCSF, or he could go to...
You understand. He wants to receive income through the University of California.
I heard you. Excuse me. All right. Enough. I heard you. What I said is you start the five conversations with the people within the university. But if he finds that there is no potential there, then maybe he needs to accept that while he would love to keep, you know, the UC thing, the UC benefit thing continuing on upward, that may not be realistic. So what I'm saying as an alternative, if that doesn't work, then it is time to say, okay, well, if I may not be able to make any, you know, more money and have everything coordinated with the UC system, at least now I'm 60, I can have my dream, which was to pass on to the next generation that tremendous amount of experience that he's gotten at Lawrence Berkeley Lab, at Caltech. Anyway, I want to thank you for the call. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm a consultant for environmental firm, and I do water quality work, and I'm pretty much the only person that does it. There's a lot of, you know, other resource areas that are covered. And I really want to move up. I'm kind of in the middle level.
Mm-hmm.
And if I do that, I need to start training people under me so that I can start. I would love to end up supervising and doing more high-level work.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm really stuck because, A, I have too much work to do, so I don't have time to train people. And, B, if I train people, I mean, it's a lot of work, and I don't know if the benefits are going to come out of it, and I don't know how do I do that so I can kind of grow professionally.
Well, a couple of thoughts. You know, it may be too big a bite or big to try to do a whole training of somebody doing what you do. But maybe there are small little tasks that you either within the context of your current job could say, okay, here is this little, we've got this special project coming up, and then try to train somebody on that and document what you've done. And the other thing is, you know, there's so many online courses, videos, whatever, on the art of management and leadership, that doing that on your own time and documenting that and letting your boss know that your dream is to move up and that here are the things you're doing, that you are indeed training people in small little chunks to try to develop your skills in that area, that you've attended a management boot camp, or that you did take this MOOC online, and that both increases your skill set where you can fit it in without major time commitments, and you're letting your boss know not only that you want to move up, but that you're really showing, you know, the initiative to do so and gaining the skills. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. Well, then I thank you very much for the call.
Thank you. If you have any recommendations for people, you know, seminars or online resources, that'd be great.
Nothing jumps to mind, but what I would encourage you to do is two things. Did you hear the beginning of the show?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm aware of how many I've read a zillion of these articles and books on management, and there were videos and whatever, and I realized there was something impersonal and abstract about that. So I took upon myself the task of crafting what would be the talk that I would give if I were a new manager, a new leader, and I tried to embed as many best practices of management and leadership as I could. So this show will be archived on the NPR and the National Public Radio website as of 10 o'clock tonight, and you can for a week, and then you can listen to it. And I think you'll find a lot there. And then also I wrote an article that I'm pretty proud of called The World's Shortest Management Course, which you can Google, and that might not be a bad starting place.
Great. Thank you so much.
Okay, you're very welcome. Great. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help?
Good morning.
Hi.
I am a professional manager with about 20 years of experience in the architecture and construction industry.
Okay.
And I'm new to the Bay Area, and it's been a very difficult process to get attention to my skills and resume through the current condition of everybody having you submit your credentials either through their website
right.
or through, you know, these...
automated tracking systems, right.
Mm-hmm. And... So as a professional, you know, I would like to hear if you have any particular tips for me on how to differentiate myself and my skills so that I can get someone's attention.
Two things. One is, you know, because there's so many applicants these days, it's almost impossible to get in through the front door unless you're a superstar. You know, and you have an amazing track record of an ascendancy, and you graduated from UVA, and, you know, all that stuff, then you've got a shot getting in through the front door because your resume is so terrific. But in most other normal cases, 20 years of experience or not, in fact, unfortunately, there is, you know, some sense that people, they would rather have somebody with 5 years of experience and a more recent skill set than somebody with 20. But there are two ways to do it. If you want to go in through the front door, the best you could do is send a series, in addition to your resume and cover letter, even though I'm well aware that it won't be read until it gets past the application tracking systems, a series of success stories. You would say sample projects, things that you accomplished, and in a, you know, 50 to 100 words each, what you did to make each of those a success. That would make you stand out in quality. The second thing is, it may be as or more likely in this terrible job market, unless you are a superstar, that you're going to get in through the back door, not the front door. The front door is answering ads. The back door is getting to know people. So there are no doubt professional associations that are related to architecture and construction management. You should become actively involved and get to people to like you, to love you. This may sound crazy, but it's almost an irrational decision to hire almost anybody without having done a major national search. So, because, you know, rationally, if they did a thorough national search, they could probably find the most amazing person who's willing to work for crap money. And so to hire you, you may or may not be the most amazing person on planet Earth, and you may or not be willing to work for crap money. So for them to hire you requires them, in some sense, to make an irrational decision, that is, to love you. And the way you get people to love you is not answering ads, but by becoming really deeply immersed in your professional association, for example, getting on the program committee where you're on this committee, the committee where they see, boy, she's really great. She's a pleasure to work with. And then they're more likely to tout you for some job so that when the job gets advertised, you're the inside candidate. Or getting informational interviews with people who are well-placed, maybe people who are alumni of the same school that you went to. You go look at your alumni directory and see who's in architecture management, construction management from your alma mater. But getting normally the best job seekers do a combination of doing a great job trying to get in through the front door with, for example, the stories, a portfolio, etc., but also devote a significant amount of their time to trying to build the relationships so they can get in through the back door. Does that make sense?
Great, it does. Thanks for the advice.
You're very welcome. Okay, let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help?
Oh, it's me?
Yep.
Oh, hi. Thank you for the intro management information. That's not what my question is about, but I learned a lot from it, as I always do from your program.
Thank you.
I just recently retired from teaching in public schools, and I started late and retired kind of early, couldn't take it much longer. But
right.
I wrote a book. I wrote a little children's book based on a project I started about 23 years ago. And it's in a lot of stores in the Bay Area, and it is sort of a spearhead or a Kickstarter for classroom teachers to either tag on to this project or start one of their own. I want to go into schools or community centers and do a book talk / presentation. Workshop, and I don't have the slightest clue of what to say to, as you worded, get in the door, who to talk to and what to say that's real brief.
I'd probably start with after-school programs. The school day is packed. Everybody's clawing at teachers to, you know, there's now the new Common Core standards, which are these incredibly rigorous standards that scare the hell out of me. Actually, they tried them in New York City, and only like 27%, they tried them last year, and only like 27% of kids passed. It's a nightmare. But the bottom line is that the day is very, very, very packed. But there are after-school, you know, in our endless attempt to try to address issues, especially in to close the achievement gap, there's a lot of money, taxpayer dollars, foundation dollars, that are used for very ever more comprehensive after-school programs, especially in places like Oakland and San Francisco and Richmond, East Palo Alto, the Canal District of the Marin and San Rafael. I'd be going to the heads of those programs and asking them if they would let you give talks. Once you do that, and if you do them well, and I would then get some kid from a local art school, there's a million filmmakers who would take wannabe filmmakers, hire them for $100 to video your presentation and edit it down to 3 minutes, then post that on YouTube, and then send a letter with including the YouTube link to principals of schools, superintendents, and you may be able to expand beyond the after-school programs. Make sense?
Yes, it does.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thanks for calling Work with Marty Nemko. Okay, so now I want to turn to topic two. As I promised, I was meditating on the fact that there are millions, literally millions, people graduated from college or graduate school this last May or early June. And many of them, the typical pattern is they take a month or two off. They say, I graduated. I want to go travel. I want to hang out. I want to do the thing. And that's, fairly, of course, perfectly understandable. But then now it gets to be July, and they're starting to think about work. And they find that, unfortunately, they're confronted with the gross oversupply of college graduates, except in things like, you know, computer science. And so they're starting to get scared. And so I thought I would devote the next segment of this show to that group of folks. And if you are either that person or you know, we all know people like that, whether they're your family members or friends, hopefully this segment will be relevant to you. And I will go certainly give out the phone number in a few minutes and ask you to call in about that problem, the problem of just starting out. But first, I always like to tell stories. I'm embarrassed that I didn't write the source. These are not from my own clients, I'm a little more careful about confidentiality. This was a published article, which, darn it, I don't write the source. So, for what it's worth, Andrew Sum. These are full names, real names. These are real names. A guy named Andrew Sum, who is an economics professor at Northeastern University, where he directs the Center for Labor and Market Studies, has found that many college graduates are falling back on jobs that don't require a college degree, waiting tables, bartending, working in retail. Using federal statistics, he found that more than 2 million college graduates under 25, 700,000 have a job that doesn't require a degree. This is something I've cited before in different contexts. And while unemployment and the lack of full-time jobs are problems, Dr. Sum says that having a job for which one is overqualified is even worse. People with a job that doesn't require a degree, even if they have such a job, earn up to 40% less than college graduates whose jobs require they have schooling. And what's worse, the longer you spend in a non-degree job, the less likely you are to join the college-educated labor force. Now, here are the stories. Kristen Vogel, she's 22. She had to move back to her home in Florence, New Jersey, after graduating from NYU, one of the more prestigious colleges in America. She still lives off of $3,000 that she received as a graduation gift, hoping it could tide her over until she finds something she feels qualified to do. Here's a quote from her. She says, "Overqualified, underqualified, I'm never the right qualified." With $30,000 in student loan debt, $1,200 to pay off on her credit card, not to mention the burden of putting pressure on her already financially strained single mother, Kristen Vogel is slowly changing the way she thinks about her future. With her loan payments due in December, she's thought about bartending a few nights a week to make some extra money. And she says, "Why did I bother taking all those tests and writing all those papers and working hard for all those years if I just have to go back to working the same jobs I worked before?" Then this article tells the story of Rachel Lieberman, who's 30. She's concerned about loan debt. She says she's got six-figure loan to repay for her joint. She went and got a master's. She thought, "Oh, I'll get a graduate degree." She got a joint master's degree in public health and business from the University of Michigan, another prestigious school, and that goes into repayment this fall. Lieberman, who pays her rent by working part-time at a national nonprofit in helping students to develop their writing skills, says that if it weren't for the 15 hours a week of work, she'd be having to make jewelry and trying to sell it on Etsy. She says the emotional pressures are as difficult as the financial ones. She says when the response is negative, it's hard to keep putting yourself out there. Who graduated from Grinnell, one of the most prestigious liberal arts colleges in the Midwest. She went and worked as a Peace Corps volunteer in Kenya. She says, quote, "What I miss most is feeling productive, that I'm part of something larger than myself. It's really hard not to have that." She says she also hates waking up in the middle of the night. She says her heart's always pounding with anxiety. One more example. Richard Stacks leaves work and comes home to his upper-class neighborhood where he lives, feeling beaten down. He's a barista. While not all parts of his underemployment have been bad, he's had time to read novels again and grown closer to his mother. He says it's not easy for him to shake the sense that life as he's living it ain't going to last forever, which he dreads. So, okay, my rule on this show, one of my rules is that I always like to, when I present the problem, but then I always like to present solutions. So I'm going to offer a bunch of solutions and then give out the phone number. It's a mistake. You know, we say, "Oh, you got a major in computer science." Today, the people who are successful, yes, they get technical, but they're not just technical. Because those purely technical jobs, yes, you can still get a job right now as a software engineer or whatever. But ever more, those jobs are getting offshored. You've got to have both hard, you have to have both hard tech skills and human skills. Communication is extremely important. I love the organization Toastmasters. So many people who are techies cannot communicate well. Toastmasters is a nurturing, supportive environment where people who are afraid to speak in public get to do so in little one-minute speeches and three-minute speeches and get feedback and support. Whatever it is, whether it's joining Toastmasters or pretending giving talks into the mirror, getting video recording yourself, get technical. But don't just be technical. If you have the combination of the people skills, the communication skills, and some technical expertise, that is probably the best guarantor of future employment in our demanding economy. Next, and of course I've said this before, but it's so critical. If I was talking to new graduates now, you want to hang out where successful people hang out, whether it be professional associations or trying to join a small volunteer board, whether it's going to social events that aren't cheap. I know you don't have a lot of money, but you spent that $100,000 or $200,000 on that degree. Go where successful people are and get them to like you. That is the best way to get jobs. And find somebody to champion you. Something my wife has said to me, she said, she gives me some of the credit for her success. I so believe in Barbara Nemco. That from day one when I met her, I kept championing her and saying, "You can do this. You can do this. Here, why don't you talk to this person?" And she, you know, having somebody who is your fan, who's not soft and just encouraging, but a loving taskmaster, can be one of the best ways to, even in this tough economy, where you can you know, that can really help you rise above the rest. Another thing I tell them is, you know, when you're in school, there's this unconscious message you get that, well, if I do the term paper, it's going to be done. It's fine. So that you essentially succeed every time you go out there. Every time you have to read a chapter, you read a chapter, it's done. Every time you write the term paper, it's done. You get a win. You get a grade every time. Job searching is not like that. So that if you go out and you work hard to apply for a job and then you don't get it or you get ignored, it's easy to get despondent. You need to have a change of mindset about looking for a job, especially again today. We've been calling this a jobless recovery for a long time, and it is. We've talked about it in other shows, the causes, but that's not what I want to talk about. That's a sidetrack for today. You need to think of a job search as what I call 100 reach outs. 100 things that you do, 100 ad, you know, a combination of answering ads, contacting employers who are not listing a good opening, making networking connections, and if you're reasonably employed, going and contacting recruiters. A job search is normally, roughly as a benchmark, 100 reach outs. If you reach out 100 times for a job that is appropriate for you. Obviously, if I reached out to the New York Knicks, say I want to play your starting forward, I could be reaching out 10,000 times. I'm not going to get hired. But if you reach out 100 times for appropriate employment, and you can in 15 or 30 seconds describe what you bring to the table, what you're looking for, not that you're open to anything, but not too specific. If you're too specific, the odds are that those 100 reach outs are not going to bear fruit. But if you make 100 reasonable reach outs, that in my mind is a good benchmark for helping you figure out what it takes to help you realize what it takes to get a job. All right, enough of that. So if you or someone you love is a recent degree holder, recent graduate, and is having trouble launching your career, the advice I've just given is good, but it's generic. I'm interested in helping you individually. I invite you to call for what I call a 3-minute workover. If you or someone you love is just starting out and struggling and would like some guidance to give you more hope, the phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. What just flashed in my head was an analogy that I think about all these colleges accepting students into journalism majors and art majors and sociology majors, and so many of them, you know, not if you're at Stanford or Berkeley or Harvard, but if you're at San Francisco State or University of San Francisco or Golden Gate or Dominican College, and I guess they changed their name, they call themselves Dominican University now, you know, they don't disclose to students what the prospects are, what the statistics are, what percentage of those journalism majors are professionally employed within 6 months of graduation. They don't say even what percent really graduate in 4 years. It really does remind me of the Tuskegee experiments when the government, without disclosing to African Americans what the treatment was and that they had syphilis, subjected them to treatments which could have been putting them in the control group and not getting their syphilis treated. The colleges are really no more ethical than that. To fail to disclose what the real odds are of success when the colleges are asking people for 4-6 years of people's lives and a fortune of money that often the people don't have, it really is no more ethical than the Tuskegee experiments. But I digress. The phone number here, if you'd like a 3-minute career makeover, especially if you or someone you love is just starting out, but if you, I'm not going to turn you away if you have a problem of any sort related to your work life. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. How can I help? Hi.
Is it me?
It is.
Ah, okay, great. You had mentioned somebody that was in the Peace Corps.
Yes.
How do you feel about serving in the military for 2 or 3 years or going to Peace Corps, VISTA, is any of that helpful in getting a job afterwards, or is it a problem?
I think it depends on the kind of work you do. I mean, if you are very, very careful in selecting a branch, not a branch of the military, but a training program that really is world class and that is not overcrowded. Like, Interestingly, 5 years ago or so, I would say that the pilot market was crowded, but I just was reading that so many of them are retiring, and the fat pay scales, and they used to be making $150,000, $200,000 a year, but that kind of has been driving the airline industry into bankruptcy. So now the airlines are paying a lot less and staying, in fact, they're making profits now, and there's apparently though still a shortage of pilots. So that if, for example, you went into the military to learn how to fly, it is, you know, you can't predict what the future is, but it looks like that might well translate into a job. But if you just go and you're a grunt and you're an infantryman or doing something that doesn't seem to differentiate you and give you a really good skill, it's not as good. And the beauty, again, of that flying example is it's very, very expensive to do it out of the military, and getting the military to provide all that equipment and all that training where you get paid to do it, that seems to make sense. So it's a matter more not whether it's a good idea or bad idea to go in the military, but being very careful about choosing a specialty that you like, that you're good at, where it promises a reasonable job market, and where the training would be something you couldn't possibly afford if you did it outside the military. That makes sense?
Yeah. Thanks for your help. Appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help?
Hello.
Hi.
My name's Aaron. I'm in downtown San Francisco, and I'm 43. Mm-hmm. Got about 2 years of undergraduate engineering required courses, and when 9/11 happened, it was a perfect time to go back to school. Couldn't quite make that happen, and been working temp and currently unemployed, and I'm thinking, well, you know, I can play. I'm thinking until I want to start a business, T-shirts, software that is not just for the 20-year-old male, but could be used for education, medicine. You know, there's a lot of technology, and I feel like I want to be entrepreneurial, but there's a gap. How do I get into that? Is there a way to maybe volunteer?
I want to understand. You said you want to create T-shirts that are related to education and medicine?
The T-shirts are entertainment. The stuff about education and medicine would be games, like video games, except they're not games. They're for doctors doing open heart surgery with head-mounted displays. Or
right.
Mechanics or teaching, you know, kids, young kids playing games to teach them how to read, arithmetic. I think they're playing the game, but they're actually learning.
It's clearly a very, very, you know, edutainment has been around for a million years, and certainly training software for everything from pilots to surgeons is ubiquitous. It is a difficult field to get into. Unfortunately, programming tends to be a young person's game.
Yeah.
That said, The only way around it is with sampling. If you are gifted in the ability to create such things, you don't have to create some software that's marketable or publishable. You're merely trying to show your chops. Do you have the chops at this point to create samples that would impress the many, many employers who are working on developing software and edutainment games, training software, immersive, you know, and these MOOCs, these massive online courses are going to be fully embedded with those kind of training modules, where if you're a surgeon, you know, they're going to give you a virtual scalpel and you're going to be figuring out how to, you know, do a kidney transplant or whatever.
Right. Like, I feel like I've been thinking about this stuff, Google Glasses, and I know I'm not the only one.
Of course not. Yeah.
And the thing is, programming, I have the ideas.
No, you know what? I'm going to, my intuition, you know, whenever somebody makes a phone call to a show like this, I have to make an intuition.
Yeah.
My intuition is that's a dream. I think you should learn about it, study about it, but I'm not convinced you're going to be the programmer working for it.
Right,
you also
right.
don't sound like a sales guy. You mentioned the T-shirts. Let's focus on the T-shirts for a moment that aren't just for the 20-year-old males. And that might be something, you know, there are, it feels like a shorter path to success. You're 43 already. You don't want to take 10 years to go and get a master's in computer science and artificial intelligence. And, you know, that doesn't feel real to me. That feels like a real interesting thing to do as a hobby.
Right.
But if, in fact, you know, T-shirts are something that, people wear until they're 80.
Right.
And if you were to find a niche that was, you know, aimed at people either of a certain, you know, age or political persuasions or whatever,
yeah,
and try and treated it like a business person, use the engineering mind that is very rigorous and logical to decide, okay, I'm going to market test these 10 prototypes.
And I feel like being here in San Francisco with a tourist, it's a special opportunity.
No, I think the tourist, that's too above the radar. That's
okay.
Too common. It would be, I'll give you just an off the top of my head example. Since you say you care about, you know, you cared about, you had a degree in engineering, what if you were to decide you were going to create a set of T-shirts for middle-aged engineers? There are many engineers who are in their 40s and 50s and are, for example, terrified of becoming seen as obsolete and replaced by a 22-year-old who's on an H-1B visa. What if you created a series of T-shirts that spoke to that population? That might be the kind of narrow niche that isn't so commonly tapped.
Like people who say, oh, I'm computer literate, and I think it's so simple. It's just, if you can read a book, you can say, no, I don't. Is that the kind of what you're talking about?
I can't quite understand what you're saying. What I'm saying is if I'm an engineer and I'm 45,
yeah,
and I've put in 20 great years,
yeah,
and I'm scared that there is some H-1B person who's 21 years old, has a new degree or whatever, I might not wear it to work, but I might wear it around the house, some kind of a clever joke that talks, that has an image of you with looking, you know, of a person who's 43 with great wisdom sitting at the computer, and then over his shoulder like a scythe, ready to cut his head off, some 19-year-old,
yeah,
you know, who's ready to take his job. See,
yeah,
you, it made you laugh, and I just came up with that off the top of my head.
Like
but a series of T-shirts like that could resonate with that narrow population, and because when you're dealing with a narrow population, it's much easier to market rather than something broad like tourists, and when you're competing with everybody under the sun who's got a stupid Golden Gate, you know, bridge T-shirt.
Mm-hmm.
Make sense?
Yeah, great.
All right, thanks for calling
Thank
Work
you
with
very
Martin
much.
It's my pleasure. All right. I will take one more call, and then I want to change gears for the last few minutes. Okay, welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help?
Hi, my name is Reed.
Hi, Reed.
San Francisco.
Hi, Reed.
I have a question about an article that appeared in the Chronicle's weekly section, I forget, Inside, I guess.
Yep.
Written by a by an English professor at USF.
Okay.
And the gist of it was there was now a market for English majors. Do you have any comment on that? Did you happen to see the article?
No, I didn't. You know, it's important to know that two-thirds of people do work outside of their majors. And certainly an argument can be made that in theory, if somebody majored in English and really did learn to write well and think well and argue well, and also the benefits of reading literature that helps you really appreciate the subtleties of the great universals of life, one could argue that person could be anything from could become a CEO or head of a nonprofit or whatever, a government agency. But the reality is that most, if you really look beyond the hype that exists in the college brochures and websites about the English major, and you looked in the trenches moment to moment, if you were to walk into USF, into their English classes, you would see, I have not done it recently, so, you know, I'm saying I would guess if it's like the many, many, many classes that I've visited, taken as classes and also visited, you would find that so much of what is learned or taught is not though teaching the really great writing and thinking skills that's practical to the real world. So I'm always hesitant to buy into the marketing machine that higher education is. They spend billions to get that article into the Insight. That's a commercial. That's just like what they call product placement. I would invite you, before you get too excited about going to school for an English major, go and visit the actual classes. Go and talk to the students who are seniors who didn't drop out, so they're already a self-selected group, but ask them about how good the job market is. And importantly, something that I have cited is the definitive study of college graduates academically adrift finds that 36% of them grew not at all in writing and critical thinking skills. So it's not a slam dunk. So I've tried to present both sides. Yes, if you really do grow that much in writing, critical thinking skills, communication skills, appreciation of great universal values, yes, it's a launch pad for any career. But in the real world, too high a percentage of people who do graduate from college in all majors, from liberal arts to the sciences, are unemployable.
Okay, it just kind of anecdotally, I am retired, but I graduated with a major in English, minor in philosophy from Stanford 50 years ago.
Right.
I made my living, more or less, eventually, by combining my writing ability with an interest in architecture, which I pursued in graduate school for a year, but never got an architecture degree. So I wrote specifications for most of my working life. I guess I'm one of those people that was able to apply whatever I learned at Stanford to that. So in my case, it was possible, but I think you're right. The professor at USF has a vested interest in promoting his Fach, as the Germans say.
Yeah. He's also got a very different student population. Remember, you went to Stanford.
Yeah.
You had a double major in English and philosophy. Stanford is the most difficult school to get into in America. That means you were very bright to begin with and very motivated and driven. You were, you know, likely could have succeeded if you majored in basket weaving. It's very dangerous for people
to generalize from that.
Yeah, not just you, but all the people who get to make it into the Chronicle or into who talk on TV or who write books. They are guilty of the enormous fallacy that you can generalize from the elite to the masses. It's a very nice egalitarian, politically correct viewpoint, but it is completely defies common sense.
Yeah, okay, so be wary.
Be wary.
Okay, thanks a lot.
I appreciate the call. You know, I had promised that I was going to read this at the top of the show, that I was going to read this this wonderful excerpt from the Chorus Line about the dilemma of these dancers, about what they're going to do if they can't achieve their dream. But I don't want to rush it. We don't even have time at all. But I will promise to do that next. I want to take one more minute, then I've got a minute. I want to end on a more optimistic note. One of my colleagues, fellow bloggers at U.S. News, a guy named Ben Weiss, he came up with a list of really good, where there really are jobs right now for those new graduates. And they are heavily at the tech end. But learn design, front-end development, and user interface. And there's a great place to learn that. It's something called Team Treehouse. You want to learn coding, rather than a university, there's a great program, something online called Code School. He says search engine optimization, of course, is critical to get a website so that it gets traffic. Learn it on distilled.net, distilled.net. You want to learn marketing? Copyblogger apparently have a great training program. You want to learn affiliate marketing, email marketing, overall online entrepreneurship? Fizzle. .co, not .com, I don't think. I think it's .co. And then finally, to learn people skills, the Dale Carnegie Leadership Skills are really industry standards with regard to that. So those are some pockets of opportunity, and that is Work with Marty Nemko for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do 3-minute workovers on callers, and I'll talk with Ken Lloyd. He's the author of Office Idiots. We'll talk about how to deal with bosses, coworkers, and employees that drive you nuts. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemko reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.